Merriglow presents 10 Commandments of a Good Entrepreneur from the series The Truth Revealed About Business Risk.
All over the world, there are a number of different consulting companies, but very few of them focus specifically on reducing and preventing business risk. One which does is Merriglow Advisory House. I had the opportunity to speak to a project manager at the company, in charge of advising small and medium-sized businesses. First of all, can you tell us what your company does?
The scope of our solutions and services is very broad, ranging from founding and managing domestic and foreign companies to resolving crisis situations in business. Primarily, however, as you mentioned, we focus on protecting entrepreneurs from business risk.
Who are your most frequent clients?
Both large and experienced entrepreneurs, as well as those just starting out who are currently only thinking about getting into business.
What led you to the idea of educating business people on the topic of how to successfully tame business risk?
As consultants, we often encounter entrepreneurs who have problems, some large, some small. But what amazes us is that we hear these stories over and over, and they're quite similar. We started thinking about why that is, and came to the conclusion that entrepreneurial adrenaline somehow pushes away all consideration of business risk. Entrepreneurs who are just starting out are particularly full of optimism. They're already counting their enormous future profits, and they fail to take any signals of possible risk seriously.
That makes sense. But don't tell me that entrepreneurs never have the opportunity to educate themselves about business risk.
Well, actually, that is the case. When we delved more deeply into the matter and studied numerous risk management books, we found they're written in a very complicated manner. We looked at it from the perspective of small and medium business people and came to the conclusion that there really wasn't any good tool for them to learn about business risk. Judge for yourself. Take cooking, for example. There are countless cookbooks, and every day on TV, some renowned chef shows us the basics of making a nice potato puree or how to fry a steak so that it's juicy. Yes, we all eat every day, but how many of us also do business every day without anyone telling us in plain language how to go about it?
That's true. Well, now I'm pretty curious to hear your basic rules of business. Do you have any introductory advice for us?
Don't risk everything for very little.
Can you elaborate on that a little?
Well, that short sentence embodies a very broad thought, which is important for every entrepreneur. Before you start a business, take a calculator and estimate your future profit. Whatever number appears on the display is nothing compared to losing all your family assets, breaking up your family, and losing your freedom. You are the only one who decides about your future business, success or failure. You alone decide the level of risk your business will take on.
Do you mean to say that we are the ones who determine the level of our success in business?
Precisely. From the very beginning, you make or break your fortune. You yourself are basically responsible for failure if you fail to respect the basic rules of business. Maybe that's because of laziness, maybe ignorance. We believe it's usually a case of ignorance, which is why we focus on educating entrepreneurs.
Well, I'm already looking forward to the first rule. At the moment, I don't run a business. I've always been a little scared, but maybe you can alleviate my fears. So what exactly is rule number one?
The kind of person you are is reflected in your business dealings.
Well, that's interesting.
If in your private life you're a bit of a bohemian, you don't mind mess and late telephone payments, you're not hungry for new information, and you aren't interested in what's going on around you, then you can't be a good business person. You have to love healthy business risk. You have to want to change something, and especially to help someone. Every kind of business helps people in some way. If you do a good job of helping your customers, you'll be rewarded financially and with praise and loyalty. Baking good bread is enough. Fixing shoes well is enough. You don't become an entrepreneur, you're born one. If you're not born an entrepreneur, you're better off not starting a business and remaining a satisfied employee.
Those are pretty strong words.
You're right, they are strong words, but true. I'll be very glad if a person thinking about going into business heeds them, thinks it over, and then decides it will be better not to go into business. Paradoxically, this is the way I can help this person the most. I'm saving them from future problems, enormous losses, and possibly from ruining their life.
Don't you think you could be discouraging lots of people from starting a business?
That's certainly not my goal. Quite the contrary. But better to have new businesses started by those who are sufficiently prepared, strong, and have the necessary talents.
That's good to hear. Would you like to add anything to this rule?
This is related to the great and often fatal mistake of employees who, for whatever reason, decide to go it alone and found their own business. They don't realise that even if they're an outstanding architect, they'll also have to be a good manager and organiser, visionary, lawyer, accountant, tax advisor and psychologist, human resources specialist, marketing expert, trader and economist. Yes, you will have to manage all of these skills on at least a basic level to be a successful entrepreneur.
In your opinion, do entrepreneurs often overestimate their strength, opportunities, and capabilities?
That's it, exactly. That's one of the reasons why so many companies fail so quickly.
So I've given it considerable thought and come to the conclusion that I have what it takes to be a successful entrepreneur. What's rule number two?
When drafting a business plan, take risk into account.
Can you explain that a little?
Nearly every day, people come in with their business plans seeking guidance. Most of these plans have one thing in common. They lack information on preventing business risk or possibly resolving risk situations. They are all only full of optimistic information and numbers. No risk to be found. Some entrepreneurs even tell us that they work on a small scale, that they don't need a business plan. However, this is a grave mistake. The fact that you don't have a business plan means that you're not giving enough thought to your overall business strategy. This leads to a high number of absolutely unnecessary mistakes, and quite often, even to the unhappy demise of the business itself.
If I understand what you're saying, you recommend that every entrepreneur has a business plan on their computer or on their desk, and they continually update it and think about strategies and risk?
Perhaps with the exception of a hairdresser who has a trade license to work at home and doesn't employ anybody. A business plan is necessary at the beginning, but then it doesn't need to be updated. But anyone interested in growing will have to continually work on their business plan, thinking about future strategies, and not just be preoccupied with the current business. If you see on paper that your business plan is not perfect, then at least put it in a drawer to work on later.
Isn't this pretty much like the old saying, measure twice, cut once?
Yes, when going into business or starting a new project, you must be very well prepared and think about all possible outcomes, consequences and risks.
Fine, so we've got a blank sheet of paper on the table or we've opened a new file on the computer and we start writing our business plan. What's the next rule? Rule number three.
Choose a field of business with a competitive advantage.
What exactly is competitive advantage?
I get the same question all the time. Entrepreneurs either don't know what competitive advantage is, or they've simply forgotten about it when starting their business. Competitive advantage is basically the most important requirement for your business to succeed over the long term. You can't buy competitive advantage. You have to work hard to win it in the market.
Can you give us some examples of competitive advantages?
Of course, a monopoly producer or provider of services. A typical example in some countries would be utility providers or a unique, innovative, creative product like Apple and its iPhone. Sometimes it's the very low or very high price of a product or service. If you have a legal problem, do you want a cheap or expensive lawyer?
Well, I'd go and see the expensive one because he's probably going to be good.
You see, precisely. Another competitive advantage could be a brand name like Coca-Cola. It could be the location of a company, maybe a restaurant in a shopping centre. And of course, there's the quality of the service or product, the personal way in which staff handle customers, and even a particular lifestyle for products like Harley-Davidson motorcycles.
Do you have any other examples?
Think about the kind of competitive advantage Porsche has. Its customers expect high prices, luxury, and quality. Today, the customers themselves want to pay a lot for the car because if they're seen driving a Porsche, everyone else thinks they're rich because they're driving an expensive Porsche. It's a question of prestige. With other brands, you don't immediately think high price.
That's true, but if you hadn't mentioned it, I wouldn't have thought that was one of their competitive advantages.
What kind of competitive advantage does a baker have at a bakery where you go to get rolls every morning? A special recipe, of course. Add to this a quality product, cleanliness and friendly staff, and you probably won't start going to a different bakery, even if there are two more close by. Once you establish your competitive advantage, it's virtually impossible to lose it unless some revolutionary change takes place or you make a serious mistake.
That's very interesting. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we move to the next rule?
Just that you should only do business in an area you really understand.
So what's the next rule? Number four.
Separate your personal and family assets from your business. A good business person, whether experienced or just starting out, should divide their assets into three parts before starting any new business. They should set aside one third for their family as a financial reserve. One third should be invested in family real estate and investment properties and assets. And the remaining third is what they are willing to invest in a business. Of course, it is necessary to strictly separate personal assets from one's business. If the business doesn't prosper, the entrepreneur will still have personal assets and financial reserves.
Even I know that. That seems to be pretty fundamental. Do you know people who don't follow this rule?
You'd be surprised at how many people don't. I've seen it many times, and we'll give you a typical example. Take a client who started his business many years ago, working out of his garage with a trade license. In the beginning, he was very successful and therefore didn't notice that he already had 60 employees and high operating loans. He only snaps back to reality when all his assets and those of his wife are seized. In the meantime, it's been a full 15 years since he started his business. Plenty of time to assess and resolve potential business risk.
That sounds horrible. I wouldn't want anything like that to happen to me. How can such a risk be handled?
Very easily. All you have to do is separate your personal assets from your business. Conduct your business through a limited liability company and make sure that as an individual, you don't take on any excessive liabilities as guarantor for the company. That way, your personal assets and financial reserves will remain untouchable.
That really is easy, but I still get shivers down my spine when I think of an executor seizing family assets passed down from my grandmother. Let's move on to rule number five.
Choose the right form of business.
What do you mean by the right form of business?
Well, to simplify things, let's only consider the basic forms of business, which are trade licenses, general partnerships, limited liability companies, and joint stock companies. Of course, there are also European companies, cooperatives, and limited partnerships, but given our short amount of time, we won't be considering these. The first two, trade licenses and general partnerships, do not protect your personal property. You're simply liable for all your obligations to the full extent of your assets. In a limited liability company, you're only liable for the assets of the company, hence the name. Your personal assets are not affected if such a company fails, and the same is true for a joint stock company.
Tell me then, who should be doing business using a trade license and who should not?
Each type of business is suited to a different form. A pedicurist who runs her business out of the house and doesn't employ anyone can afford to work through a trade license. But an architect who may not employ anyone but also works out of the home would be risking quite a lot by working through a trade license. What if a building she's designed collapses and the insurance company refuses to cover a large part of the damage? She could end up paying for the rest of her life and easily lose everything.
And what about larger entrepreneurs and companies?
Larger companies generally have sorted this out already because they have money for quality consulting and they conduct business as a limited liability company or joint stock company or a European company. But even here, one finds exceptions. I've met some people running very large businesses who, after 20 years, are still operating under their trade licenses.
You're not serious.
It's true. If I were them, I wouldn't be able to sleep at night. There are so many risks, it's really a case of, hey, I survived today, let's see about tomorrow.
Do you have any other advice in this regard?
Depending on the anticipated size of the business, every entrepreneur should already have a business structure prepared in advance to match the size or anticipated size of business, which will protect assets against business risk and address tax planning and business strategy.
What's rule number six?
Do business by yourself or pick your partners very carefully. Let me begin with a story. Two childhood friends founded a joint company with 50-50 shares, and everything was running like clockwork. Over 20 years, they built up a colossal company. They produced office furniture. They exported to many countries all over the world. This was all well and good until one of them divorced and found a young, very attractive girlfriend. Before long, the second partner had also fallen for her, and she ended up sleeping with both of them.
How did the story end?
Pretty much as you'd expect. Family catastrophes and the huge collapse of a very well-managed company. The competition soon steamrolled them and they lost everything.
That really happened?
Of course, and it isn't an isolated case.
But how can you prevent such unfortunate situations?
Very easily. When establishing a joint company, pay thorough attention to the founding document. And here I would add an imaginary exclamation mark, or perhaps 10 exclamation marks. If you have to have a business partner, reserve the right to make decisions in important matters. Your joint business may be threatened simply by the fact that at a given moment, you aren't able to make the right decision quickly. You devote a large portion of your life to building a company. You certainly don't want to see the company fail after several years because of some banality.
Isn't this sending a signal to my partner right from the beginning that I'm not terribly sincere about our joint partnership, that I want to have the upper hand?
Certainly not. If you've chosen the right partner, they'll understand. Even they will be glad to have everything clear from the start. If they don't understand, and if they insist on having an equal share in the company, including decision-making rights, don't go for it.
But in that case, one of the equal partners has to give up their share of profits and decision-making rights. You think that's okay?
Absolutely. If I have to do business with a partner, there must be a reason. This partner has to be beneficial to me in some way, which is why you make that clear in the beginning and establish your roles in the company, including decision-making rights and profit shares.
Well, that seems pretty complicated to me.
Any good consultant or lawyer can help you draw up a balanced and mutually beneficial founding charter, or partner, or shareholders agreement.
Do you think that's a good solution?
It's a good solution if I want or need to have a partner. But if there is any way at all to pursue the venture on my own, I'll have 100% control of the company, which is ideal.
But then how will I be able to work with this partner?
That's simple. Conclude a cooperation or mediation agreement or work performance contract and set the shares of profit. Agree to cooperate for as long as it suits both parties. If the situation no longer suits you, just terminate the agreement. Nobody can touch your share in the company and you still have 100% decision-making authority.
Okay, now I understand a little better. Can you give me some other examples?
Of course, it's a very important topic. Relatively frequently, we get clients whose partner has withdrawn all the money from the company and now they're not communicating. They want to wind up the company, but because they only own 50%, the company's general meeting can't pass any resolutions.
So then how do you handle it?
It's not easy. In such situations, you really have to come to an agreement with the partner. We often act as mediators and arrange an agreement and wind up the company, but it doesn't always work out.
You have completely convinced me that it's better to keep your business firmly in your own hands. So what's rule number seven?
Establish the right price for starting your business.
Explain to me what this rule entails.
Imagine that you decide to get into the restaurant business and you buy one that's already running. It has a given location, kitchen capacity, seating capacity, and bar. You've only got enough money to finance 30%, so you get the rest from a bank. For collateral, you put up the restaurant you're buying, your family home in the city, as well as a cottage in the country. The bank lends you 70% of the value of your collateral. The current profits of the restaurant are not that encouraging, but you like the architecture of the place and therefore agree to the price, which does not correspond to the restaurant's economic performance. You simply overpay, and you think, well, I'll manage, I'll get 50% more people in, I'll cook better, I'll raise prices.
And that's bad?
Of course, because the reality could be completely different, and it's an enormous risk. You won't be able to increase the kitchen capacity or the seating capacity without considerable investment. And you can't change the restaurant's location. Plus, the manufacturing plant next door might shut down and you could lose 60% of your lunch clientele.
Is there any way to minimise that risk?
Again, it's relatively easy. Don't let yourself get carried away with entrepreneurial euphoria. Rely on common sense. Don't rely on the numbers you get from the seller without first verifying them. Maybe you can lease the restaurant for a year. Try to tie the purchasing price to future revenue and agree to installment payments. Certainly forget about securing a bank loan with your own family assets.
What's rule number 8?
Have financing for the entire project ready in advance, including reserves.
What do you mean by that?
Before you start doing business, first secure the necessary financing.
That can't be easy for entrepreneurs who are just starting out.
That is true. It's not easy. Financing must always be handled on a case-by-case basis, depending on the area of business, the size of the company, the type of collateral available, the time required for investment. It's best to use your own funds and start a project when you have the amount required. That's what experienced entrepreneurs do who are already getting returns from one or more projects.
But what if I'm really just starting out and don't have any money, but I still want to start a business as soon as possible?
You can borrow from your family, but that will immediately put you on very thin ice. What will happen if your business isn't successful? How will you pay your family back? What if you don't pay the money back? Won't that put a permanent strain on your family relationships?
That really could lead to a lot of problems.
And what will happen, on the other hand, if your business is successful? Won't some of your relatives become envious or pressure you to give them jobs with high salaries for little work, since they helped you get started? You should consider such questions first before going to your family for money.
What kind of other options are there for financing?
A bank loan is the most natural and common form of financing for a new business, but a person frequently must put up personal assets as collateral. The bank will probably want to put a lien on all of your personal and family assets. This is naturally quite a looming threat, and you must keep in mind what might happen if you're not able to make the loan payments in time. It's quite possible you could lose all of your family assets.
So what would you recommend?
A very underutilized approach, which I believe to be the best way to finance a new enterprise, is to find an experienced entrepreneur. Such a person is already familiar with possible risks and has made enough money to have reserves for rainy days, as well as investing in projects such as yours. If an experienced entrepreneur says they like your project, then there's a high probability you'll be successful in your venture. If they say they don't like it, then you're probably better off not starting the business.
So we've talked a little about possible sources of funding new projects. Now tell me what you meant when you said you should have financing, including reserves. Why do you need to have reserves?
We often encounter entrepreneurs who decided to start a new project without having secured funding until the business turns a profit, and even more who did have funding but did not count on the possible risks of the new project and did not have the necessary reserves. They were not able to keep the business running, even if it was basically all put together and needed just a little more time to turn a profit.
Do you have any specific examples?
Well, for example, I know an entrepreneur who invested his entire family savings of £400,000 into buying and renovating buildings. He needed another £60,000 for equipment. He couldn't think of anything else but borrowing from a loan shark.
How did it turn out?
As you might guess, he nearly lost everything. We helped him come to an agreement with the loan shark and pay him off, but it was just by the skin of his teeth. Never borrow from a loan shark.
So, what's rule number 9?
Think about company costs in advance and continually try to optimise these.
That's pretty obvious, isn't it?
Unfortunately, it's not. This is a very tricky risk which is very often overlooked. Moreover, it has been shown that entrepreneurs are fairly allergic to reducing costs.
Can you explain a little?
Let me begin with another case from my personal experience. This one involved a medium-sized company with a more experienced businessman who used his limited liability company to buy some property using his own funds. He then renovated the property and equipped it to process and freeze freshwater fish. For distribution, he decided to deliver his products directly to customers at home. He bought 30 customized freezer trucks, hired 30 drivers, and bought them mobile phones and tablets. After a relatively short period of time, it became clear that there was no demand for direct delivery to the end customer, even though he added other frozen goods to his assortment. The main customers were large supermarket chains, which required only half the fleet. He had to let 15 drivers go with severance, return 15 vehicles to the leasing companies at a loss, pack up the 15 phones and tablets, and bite the bullet on the mobile phone contracts. When he added up the losses from his poor decision and high costs, the amount was upwards of several hundred thousand pounds.
An interesting story. So what's the lesson?
You just have to think in advance about your costs and don't take needless risks. You can buy vehicles gradually and test the waters. Get advice. Use common sense.
It seems to me that just about every entrepreneur could have a similar experience to a greater or lesser extent.
Exactly. You're making decisions about future investments at every moment, and the decisions aren't always right. It's necessary to thoroughly consider costs and calculate. This doesn't apply just to initial costs and investments, but also operating costs. Even these must be continually monitored and optimized. This way, you can save a great deal of resources, which can be used to grow your business.
And just like that, we're already at rule number 10.
Keep written accounts of all your business relationships from the beginning.
That's pretty obvious, isn't it?
You would think so, but this issue is quite common among smaller entrepreneurs.
Really?
Yes.
And how do you convince them to put all of their verbal agreements in writing?
I ask them whether they might want to sell their company at some time in the future.
And what do they say?
Probably at some time they would, but after they get old, and if their children decide not to keep the business going.
And then what do you tell them?
Imagine that you're meeting with a potential investor in your company, and he asks you about your relationships with suppliers and buyers. You answer that they're your good friends, and that you've always been able to come to an agreement with them. Except the investor might not come to an agreement so easily, and thus the value of your company is automatically reduced.
Do you mean to say that having written contracts with business partners has a direct impact on the value of the company?
Precisely, in spite of the fact that even verbal agreements are valid. Simply put, get it in writing.
Well, do you have any more recommendations with respect to that last rule?
Yes, I do, and it's very important. Before you sign anything, read it carefully. And more than once. If there's something you don't understand, find an expert. Always communicate and negotiate with the second party. Contracts should reflect the agreement between two or more parties, and they should be balanced.
Right at the beginning, you had some advice for us. Do you have any words to leave us with?
Yes, I do. Don't spend more than you make, and set aside reserves for a rainy day.
Well, everybody knows that, don't they?
If everybody did these things, I certainly wouldn't be mentioning it. There are plenty of business people who, after their initial success, are still capable of losing everything. They start living beyond their means.
That's true. Not long ago, I read about a similar case, and it wasn't a small-time entrepreneur.
Good times are also certain to be followed by bad times. It's not a question of if bad times will come, but simply when.
What would you like to say to listeners in conclusion?
If you know these rules and you follow them, you will repeatedly find that you're doing the right thing. But if you don't know or you don't follow them, then you really should give it some serious thought and make some changes to better protect your family, your business and your assets from the many business risks which lurk around every corner. The point of these lessons is not to discourage you from going into business. The point is to help you set the right course so that you don't risk everything for very little. And if you've already made some of these entrepreneurial mistakes, you should know there's no shame in that. There's only shame if you fail to learn from them.
Thank you for the interview. I look forward to speaking with you next time.